And we're going to read a couple texts here as we kick off into our message. Kind of review the story a little bit, and then we'll get started. Book of Job, chapter number 1. It says in verse 1, "There is a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance was also 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, and 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 she-asses, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the east." Now we'll jump over to verse 13. It says, "And there was a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a messenger unto Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee.' While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, 'The fire of God has fallen from heaven and hath burned up the sheep and the servants, and consumed them, and I am escaped alone to tell thee.' While he was yet speaking, there came another, and said, 'The Chaldeans made out 3 bands, and fell upon the camels, and have carried them away. Yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I am escaped alone to tell thee.' And while he was yet speaking, came also another, and said, 'Thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in thy eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the 4 corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are all dead. And I alone am escaped, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee.' Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, 'Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.' In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly." Now jump over to chapter 2, verse number 7. It says, "So went Satan forth from the presence of the Lord, and smote Job with sore boils, from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself withal, and he sat down among the ashes. Then said his wife unto him, 'Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die.' But he said unto her, 'Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? So shall we receive good at the hand of God and not receive evil?' In all this did not Job sin with his lips." Now when Job's 3 friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Namathite. For they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him." Now, Job, suffice to say, had a bad day. In a brief span of time, he'd gone from being the greatest man in the East, as it says in verse 3 of chapter 1, to being a pussy, penniless nothing, socially speaking. In an effort to comfort him, 3 of his friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, share their ideas, very wrong ideas, as to why these things were going so poorly for Job. Now, in our humanity, we may be too quick to judge and interpret why things have happened either to us or to other people, when sometimes we need to just admit that we don't know. What I want to do this evening is, I don't want to do the standard message you usually hear from the book of Job, which is in the first 2 chapters you can talk about what happened, the demonology that we see with what's going on between Satan and God when the angels met. I don't want to discuss his wife's response or his response. What I want to talk about is the advice or the perspective offered by Job's 3 friends later in the text. And what I want to look at is the fact that there are 3 wrong perspectives. They're similar in ways, but there are differences to them that show their theology. And I want to explain the fact that sometimes we have to admit that we just don't know why things happen. We sometimes judge and say, oh, that happened to her or him because of this, or this is what God's trying to do. when sometimes we just need to say, hey, stuff happens. Stuff happens. And so I want to preach a message entitled, Stuff Happens. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, I want to thank you for this day. Thank you for those who came out this evening. And Lord, thank you that the church can continue to operate in the pastor's absence. We've obviously noticed he's not here. Lord, I pray that he'll receive ministry where he is. And Lord, I pray that we'll hear from you and use me as your vessel. And Lord, I pray that we all become more like you in your Son's name. Amen. The three wrong perspectives. Now, what we're going to see as we go along is there's two major common denominators between the ideas shared to Job by his friends who came to comfort him. And the first one is that these things are Job's fault. And the second one is that it's God that's doing it to him. Okay? Those are both wrong. But I want to look at the other things that are happening within their interpretations of the facts. What you have in the book of Job is these things happen, and then you have a discourse between the three friends and Job regarding the events that have occurred and their interpretation of what happened. And then Job, you know, rebuffs what they're saying, and then they argue back. And they each get at least two times to speak, three in one case, I believe, and then God chimes in at the end. And so we're going to end up flipping through a little bit as we systematize what is being said. But we're not leaving the book of Job, okay? So we're staying within the confines of this book. So when I say, now flip over two, you're only going a few pages one way or the other. So the first perspective I want to look at is that of Eliphaz, the first thing that he said. And he has what I've called the punishment correction perspective. Oh, these things are happening to you, it's because God is punishing you for something, or God's correcting you, or trying to get your attention. So if you flip over to Job chapter number 4, we're not going to look through the entirety of everything they say. We're just going to look at the highlights that kind of summarize their arguments. So Job chapter number 4, and he gives his accusation of a double life. He accuses Job of living a double life in verses 3 through 8. It says, "Behold, thou hast instructed many, thou hast strengthened the weak hands, thy words have upholden them, or him that was falling, thou hast strengthened the feeble knees." He says that, Job, you've portrayed yourself as being someone who is strong. When other people needed help, you know, you are the man to talk to. It says in verse 3, you've instructed many. You've strengthened the weak hands. Okay? Thy words have upholden him that was falling. Thou hast strengthened the feeble knees. When there were other people were having trouble, they were coming to you, and you were giving them strength, you were giving them encouragement, you were showing them how to get through the events that they were facing. So you've portrayed yourself as being quite strong, but then he says, well, now we see the truth, verses 5 through 8. But now it has come upon thee, and thou faintest. It touches thee, and thou art troubled. Is it not that thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and the uprightness, or is not this, sorry, thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and the uprightness of thy ways? He says quite clearly in verse 6, this is showing us who you really are. Sure, you've strengthened other people, but now this has come upon you. Isn't this what the way you're living is leading to? Isn't this? He's come to Job, and Job, it doesn't say that the house that he was living in collapsed, just that the one that his children were meeting in, and that he'd lost everything, and that, you know, he got the fields burning, and the armies have made off with his goods, and they're saying, well, look, isn't this what you've really amounted to? You can help other people, but you can't help yourself. Job couldn't deal with his own trial. It says in verse 7, remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent? Or where were the righteous cut off? When has stuff like this ever happened to someone who was a good person? Job. When did you see the good people losing their flocks and their family dying? Okay, verse 8, even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. As listen, the only way this kind of thing has happened to you is if you were living wickedly. He says very clearly in verse 8, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness, of course, is just farming illusion. Listen, you have been behaving in a way that has planted the seed of evil, and now here it is blossoming on you. This must be what's happening. That's the interpretation Eliphaz puts forth. Now he asserts that God is not just punishing him, but chastening him in the next chapter, chapter 5, verses 17 and 18. He continues in this chapter, and here he says, "Behold, happy is the man whom God correcteth. Therefore despise thou not the chastening of the Almighty, for he maketh sore and bindeth up, he woundeth, and his hands make whole." He's saying, listen, God is correcting you. You need to pay attention, Job, to what God is doing to you here. You need to take great joy in what you see happening around you. Now, the problem with that is we know from chapter 1, that's not the case. And we'll get to that in a minute. He says, God's trying to get your attention. This kind of thing happens to evil people who God wants to turn around. I mean, look. And he further attacks Job's character in chapter 15. If you flip over to chapter 15, yeah, we're going to do a lot of page turning here. He further attacks his character in verses 12 and 13. Eliphaz says, "Why doth thine heart carry thee away? And what do thy eyes wink at?" Heart, the innermost part of who you are. What is it about you that's moving you away from God? Away from God. And what do thy eyes wink at? What is it you're choosing not to see in your life that's causing these things? Verse 13, "That thou turnest thy spirit against God and lettest such words go out of thy mouth." He says, you know, in summary, you're against God. You're ignoring sin, okay? Your heart is carrying you away. And he said, he interprets the situation as this is God punishing you and trying to get your attention. Now, we know back from chapter 1, okay, that that's not the case. And if at any point your fingers get tired of turning, I mean, you can just do a stretch. That's okay. I won't be distracted, okay? But chapter 1:1, it clearly says, refers to Job as that man was perfect and upright, one that feared God and eschewed evil. This is not someone whose heart is carrying him away. This is not someone who's seeing evil and saying, I'm just going to choose not to see that. I'm going to carry on and act like that's not happening over there. Down in verses 4 through 12, it says, "And his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually." He wasn't ignoring any sin. He said, my children have gotten together and they've had this time together. Now, just in case they've done something wrong, I'm going to go to the Lord, not knowing if they had acted corruptly. I'm going to go to the Lord and I'm going to seek him and I'm going to seek forgiveness for them. He's not somebody who ignored sin. He's not somebody who ignored the plausibility of sin. When it says in verse 1 that he eschewed evil, that means he shunned it. He wanted nothing to do with it. When evil was proposed to him, he wouldn't have it. It said he's perfect. Obviously, no human's perfect. That's the idea of blamelessness. You couldn't look at Job and say, yeah, well, Job, and put a sinful name on it. He's a thief, or he's a liar, or he's a whatever. It wouldn't stick. People go, Job? Nah. No, he's a good guy. No. And now here's Eliphaz saying, well, God must be getting your attention. You must be away from God. You must have sin in your life that you're choosing to ignore and not deal with. What we have here is Eliphaz is attacking the character of a good man. And he's interpreting his circumstances without having all the facts. The facts are found in verses 6 through 12. It says now, in verse 6, chapter 1, verse 6, "There was a day when the sons of God," these were the angels, of course, "came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect man and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil?" So now we have God's perspective. This guy was doing well enough in life that God was bragging on him. Okay? Verse 9, "Then Satan answered the Lord and said, doth God Doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made a hedge about him, and about his house, and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. He's saying, listen, the only reason that Job guy serves you is because he's so blessed. You've done him well. He's in it for what he can get. This is what Satan is claiming. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. We see as the situation is quite the opposite of what Eliphaz was claiming was the case. Well, God must be real mad at you. Well, no, it turns out he was a model follower of the Lord. And these things were happening because of the confidence God had in him over the accusations Satan was making. Things were quite the opposite to what they appeared to be. But Eliphaz was practicing convenient thinking. Well, bad things are happening to you. You must be bad. But that's also nearsighted thinking. Okay? He can't know what's going on in the heavens. He doesn't know what we read in chapter 1. He just walked up, looked around, made a conclusion. Well, according to my information, this is your fault. You did this. You got to fix it. But really, as far as Job is aware, everything was fine one day, and the next day it was all gone. And he was man enough to be willing to accept it. Now, I think we need to be careful about how we view the trials that others might be facing. You see someone going through a problem or having some sort of a difficulty, and we got to make sure we're not saying, oh, she's getting punished. You know that thing that she did, and we know it, and oh, God knows it too, now she's getting what's coming to her. Oh boy. No, I always knew that guy was a bad person. Now he's getting it. This happened, that happened. That doesn't just happen. God must be doing that to him. You know? Now those things may be the case. Okay? We know from Proverbs 3, 11 and 12 that God does chasten his children. But who are we to say at a time where someone's going through a trial that that's happening? Really, that's guesswork on our part. Oh, God's doing this. Well, no offense. You and me don't know that. We don't know it. We need to be very careful about approaching it that way. That's how Eliphaz approached this situation. I mean, do we really know things that we think we know? Or are we just jumping to conclusions sometimes? Oh, that car accident happened because you're not a good believer and God's trying to get your attention. Oh, this person passed away. Well, God must really need that family to look up to him now. They must not have been. Like, that's not necessarily fair. Only because we don't know it to be true. The punishment correction view. Now, Bildad, the second friend, offers the prosperity theology point of view. Call it prosperity theology or the prosperity gospel. And he makes his little spiel starting in chapter 8. So he is featured in Job chapter number 8. Bildad reasons that Job's newfound poverty is a result of his sin. So again, you see the common theme of this is your fault and God's doing this to you. But his reasoning, the way he discusses it, is slightly different. Chapter 8, verse 3. Doth God pervert judgment? Or doth the Almighty pervert justice? If thy children have sinned against him, and he have cast them away for their transgression, if thou wouldest seek unto God betimes, and make thy supplication to the Almighty, if thou wert pure and upright, surely now he would awake for thee and make the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous. Though thy beginning was small, yet thy latter end should greatly increase. In verse 4, he makes the claim that God had judged Job's children. And this was a very cruel thing for a friend to say to someone. It comes right out. Well, if thy children have sinned against him and he have cast them away for their transgression, your kids must have been doing something in there. He wiped them out right away. That was the first thing he had to say. I don't know. For me, the conversation would be over. Your kids are dead because they're a bunch of, okay, you're out of here. Get off of my burnt up property. Get out of here. But he listens to what he has to say. He says in verses 5 through 7, he reasons that Job must be evil because things only get better for good people. It says in verse 5, if thou wouldest seek unto God betimes and make thy supplication to the Almighty. You know, if you were looking after God, if you were praying to the Lord God, if thou wert pure and upright, okay, these are the conditions. If you were seeking after God, if you were a good person, if you were an upright man, if you were who you claimed, really, to be, surely now He would awake for thee. Surely God would be paying attention to you at this point. Surely when you go through a problem, if you were a good person, God would come to your aid and make thy make the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous. Surely He'd return your riches to you. Surely that would be the case. Verse 7, though thy beginning was small, yet thy latter end should greatly increase. You start small, and as you obey the Lord, it should get bigger and better for you, right? People who follow God don't accumulate things and then just fall off the map. This is classic prosperity theology, okay? Prosperity theology is the idea that wealth, health, and power are given by God to those who have faith in Him and obey Him. If you lack wealth, health, and power, you're not faithful and you're not obedient to God. That's the thinking that Bildad has in this text. Well, you lost all your stuff. You'd be prosperous if you were obeying the Lord. You don't have those things. He doesn't have His health. He doesn't have His wealth. He's not prominent anymore. It all disappeared. That's not how it works. Now, Bildad emphasizes Job's supposed wickedness later in the book. He talks again in chapter 18. So I'm going to flip over to chapter 18. In verse 5. This is where Bildad makes his major accusation about Job's character. Chapter 18, verse 5 says, yea, the light of the wicked shall be put out, and the spark of his fire shall not shine. I jump over to verse 17. His remembrance shall perish from the earth, and he shall have no name in the street. He shall be driven from light into darkness and chased out of the world. He shall neither have son nor nephew among his people, nor any remaining in his dwellings. They that come after him shall be astonished at his day, and they that went before were affrighted. Surely such are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him that knoweth not God. He's saying, those people that are evil, God takes everything away from them. Their family, their property, their prosperity, everything. It disappears. He's classifying Job as someone, as it says in verse 21, him or the wicked and someone who knows not God. Well, because these things are happening to you and you're not becoming prosperous and you're losing your health and your wealth, you obviously are evil and you don't know God. There we go. Signed, sealed, put in the mail. Bildad uses Job's temporal circumstances to question his spiritual position. You're not even a believer. You can't be. I mean, look, you have nothing now. There's no way you gained what you gained through honest means and by seeking the Lord and being blessed by Him, because He doesn't do this to people that follow Him. You know, people that are obedient and faithful to Him, they don't go through hard times, Bildad reasons. Therefore, you have to be evil and you have to know not God, because look. Bildad's erroneous idea about how God operates led him to inappropriate comments about both Job and his children. The better you are, the richer you are. The better you are, the healthier you are. The better you are, the more prominent, the more powerful you are. Okay? Well, quick quiz. There were how many perfect people that lived on planet Earth? Nobody knows. Okay, there was one, right? You're all like, I knew that. Well, thanks for answering. Good. Okay, there was one. Perfect person was born in a stable. Yes, thank you. See, I heard that under your breath, so that's so quiet. That's the next one. Thank you. Okay, he was raised in a town called Nazareth, right? And we know that was pretty much the ghetto of Galilee, because Nathanael says in John 1:46, you know, can there any good thing come from Nazareth? Jesus is from where? What? Nothing comes out of Nazareth. That place is a cesspool. Okay, so he started badly, right? He started in a bad place, in a bad way. He should have been, he lived perfectly, so he should have been okay by the end of his life. So he died. Oh yeah, he was executed. Right. Okay. He became humble. He became obedient unto death. Philippians 2:8. It says in 2 Corinthians 8:9 that Jesus became poor. He intentionally became poor. And that was for our sake. So if Jesus Christ, our ultimate example, became poor, at what point was this Christian life all about prosperity and wealth? You know, it's all about obeying God and God will bless you and you'll have things and you'll have stuff and everything will go well for you. It didn't go that way for the Christ. It didn't go that way for the apostles. Not in this life, anyway. Now, let me emphasize, it's not wrong to have things. I'm not saying that because I'm not on the higher end of the middle class. That's not okay. That's not what I'm saying. You have stuff, fine. Okay? That's not a problem. It's actually noted in Ecclesiastes 3:13 that it is a gift of God to, you know, to enjoy the good of your labor. Okay? Those things that come from that which you earn, the work, the stuff you have. It's not wrong to have stuff. If you have stuff and you have wealth, I'm actually very happy for you, okay? That is fantastic. Now, living for things we know is wrong, okay? We knew that from 1 Timothy 6:10. At least I think that's, yeah, 1 Timothy 6:10. Living for things is wrong. Having things is not, okay? If you inherited millions of dollars, don't think now you're on the wrong end of this Christian life perspective, okay? If you've built up a business and you have money, or you've gotten a good job and you have money, that's not wrong. You don't need to feel good about or bad about having stuff. You know, I really don't care for those commercials every Christmas when, you know, people are giving each other presents, and so then that's when the charities decide it's time to show you the same pictures of those kids in Africa that are starving. How dare you have things when they have nothing, you know? It's not wrong to have things. It's not. And we should be charitable. It's not wrong to have things. However, having things and stuff is not an indicator of how pleased God is with someone. Well, I'm rich. I'm loaded. I'm healthy. I'm popular and powerful. God must think I'm awesome. No. Well, if that was the case, all the super rich drug dealers, no, they're not all super rich, but there are wealthy ones, drug dealers and pimps, okay? The sleazy executives who lie and fraud and steal, the entertainers who make hundreds of millions of dollars pumping all sorts of dirty content and anti-biblical messages into society must be God's favorite people. Because they've got money, lots of it. That's no way to measure, okay, where you stand with Christ, with what you have. And so we have the punishment correction perspective offered by Eliphaz. We have the prosperity gospel or prosperity theology view offered by Bildad. And then finally we have Zophar, who has nothing good to say. He has the perdition view. He comes right down on Job and has nothing positive to say to him. So perdition view. Zophar claims that God is simply destroying an evil man. And we'll see furthermore, tells Job that he deserves worse than what he's getting now. Right? We switch to chapter number 11. Chapter number 11, this is where Zophar makes these comments. Verse 3. Should thy lies make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed? For thou hast said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee. And that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth. Verses 4 and 5. If God was right here, right now, he'd lay into you, buddy. You've made the claim, my doctrine's pure, I'm clean, I've been following the Lord. I've been worshiping. Verse 5, but oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee. He'd say something to you. If God was here, he'd have something to say to you. I mean, look what he's already said. Okay? Verse 6. That he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double that which is. Know therefore, you know this, that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth. You haven't gotten what you deserve yet. The fact that God has taken all this away from you, he was being merciful to you. You are one little rat. He's half stomped you, but you deserve far worse than what you've gotten. Zophar arrogantly thinks that he knows what God is thinking and how God would act if he was standing in that meeting. Oh, I know a thing or two about God, Job, and I'm going to let you know right now. He further says down in verses 14 and 15, it says, if iniquity be in thine hand, put it far away, and let not wickedness dwell in thy tabernacles. For thou shalt lift up thy face without spot, for then shalt thou lift up thy face without spot. Yea, thou shalt be steadfast, and thou shalt not fear. Jump to verse 20. But the eyes of the wicked shall fail, and they shall not escape, and their hope shall be as the giving up of the ghost. Now, giving up of the ghost is death. When you die, your spirit separates from your body. That's the giving, okay? That's what that refers to. He comes right out and he says, you're lucky that you're alive. It's time to shape up or ship out. Verses 14 and 15. If iniquity be in thine hand, put it far away. Let not wickedness dwell in your tabernacles. That evil that brought this on you, you better get rid of it. You better get rid of it, he says, for then thou shalt lift up thy face without spot. He's trying to give someone who God referred to as blameless and God-fearing advice on how to be blameless and God-fearing. Okay, this is arrogance to a T. This is someone who thinks he knows things, but he doesn't. Verse 20, but the eyes of the wicked, a.k.a. you, shall fail, and they shall not escape, and their hope shall be as the giving up of the ghost. Listen, you either get this right, or you just wait for God to kill you. Because he should have done it already, essentially, is what we're getting from this guy. Now remember, this was all based on Job's sudden, unfortunate circumstances. Now I wonder, when they came to this meeting, did nobody here feel the impulse at all to offer aid? You walk up to the guy, he's got nothing. He's in what's left of his property. All his material wealth is gone other than this house. His wife's not overly pleased. His family's gone. He's in mourning. He's sitting on a pile of ashes. And nobody walked up and said, hey, you need any food or water? Or do you want to sleep in my place for a little while? Or is there nobody? No, it's just, you're evil and God's going to get you and da-da-da-da-da. Well, thanks for showing up, guys. I really appreciate that. Man, with friends like you, who needs the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans and the fire of God and the wind? Who needs that, right? Man, can't wait till next week's ice cream social. This is great, you know. This is a good sense of community, you know. Now, they're all assuming that God is doing these things and that somehow Job had deserved it. You know, nobody thought a few days before there was anything wrong. Everything was fine. Everybody thought Job was the man. And now, because of some unfortunate series of events, now he's the worst thing on this earth. How do we go from A to B? And how do we interpret that? And how do we respond to that? Not this way. Not like we know everything that's going on. Now, Zophar further declares himself to be wise and refers to Job as wicked in chapter 20. So Job chapter 20, verse 3, it says, I have heard the check of my reproach. So Job had responded to something that he had said earlier. And the spirit of my understanding causeth me to answer, knowest thou not this of old, since man was placed upon the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment. I really like verse 3. And the spirit of my understanding causeth me. I've heard what you've had to say, pal, and, you know, big, genius, wise, intelligent me just can't help but answer. I'm so smart and you're so dumb. I'm going to put it to you on what is going on here. Knowest thou not this of old, he says, the triumphing of the wicked is short. You've had your triumph and it's gone now. You had a brief time where you were great and now you're nothing. Why? Because you are, as it says there, wicked and a hypocrite. You're getting what's coming to you. Now, down to verses 27 through 29. The heaven shall reveal his iniquity, and the earth shall rise up against him. The increase of his house shall depart, and his goods shall flow away in the day of his wrath. And this is the portion of the wicked man from God, and the heritage appointed to him by God. Everything that's happened to you is stereotypical of bad people. God is just destroying somebody who's evil. That is his friendly gesture to his buddy Job. Now what we see is that all three of his friends say that he was to blame. All three of them walked in and rushed to judgment. But we see that all three of them were wrong in verse 40, in chapter 42. Chapter 42, verse 7. It says, and it was so that after the Lord had spoken these things unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. When God finally chimes in, the one Zophar said would come down here and chew out Job, he's got nothing good to say to the three advisors. Are you guys kidding? Job's right and you're wrong. You know, he tells them that they have to make sacrifice in the next verse. You guys are wrong. You guys need to get right with me. The one who's been right with me the whole time is Job. You guys, with your prosperity gospel and your correction punishment point of view and your perdition statements, you're wrong. That's not how God works. Well, you think because you've got money that you're better off than him spiritually? No. No. You think just because something happened to him that I must be upset with him? No. No. So how do we make the rubber meet the road? Well, I have had a bad couple weeks. Now, I'm not asking for any help. Okay, I'm not asking for anything. I'm just using what has occurred to me in the last, you know, 2 or 3 weeks as an example of, you know, how much disappointment the Lord must have with me according to these three guys. Okay, now it was a Saturday a few weeks ago. Okay, we had a birthday party for my youngest son. He turned one, so I guess we're talking about a month ago. And my cat, how old was he? 5 months old. 6 months old. He went out in the morning, and that was normal. That was fine. He's a Norwegian forest cat, so his impulses are to be in wide open spaces and climb up trees. And he didn't come back in the evening, okay? So we didn't know where he was. My wife got freaked out. She went up and down the street looking for him. She found him way up a tree at the end of the block. And I had to go over there and climb up there and get it. I'd talked to the homeowner, and we went over, and I climbed up the tree, and it was a pine tree, so I went up there with my gloves and I went right to the top, and the cat was way over on the edge, and he was like, you know, the branch was going to snap. So I grabbed him, and we were instantly both stuck up in the tree for a little while till I figured out how to get down. Okay, so I thought, there's my adventure for the next month or two. I'll have this great story to tell. I'll use this at teen time or something. So anyway, got that, figured that out. Then I wasn't feeling too good that weekend, so I was kind of ill, so I lost my health, okay? I saved my cat, but I lost my health. I get up Monday morning, go downstairs into the kitchen, and there's just water all over the floor. My fridge had died at some point during the night. Okay, well, my fridge is gone. It came with the house. I don't know how old it is anyway. It's gone. No big deal. I told my wife on the way out the door. I go out the door 5 in the morning. Okay, fridge is dead. Cat went up a tree. Fridge is dead. Then, I think it was the next day. Anyway, these might not be in perfect order. My daughter gets strep throat, and she becomes fiercely ill. So he has to go into the ER. Okay, so we have to make an exception for life. Now she has to go to the ER and have to sit there for hours. And okay, fine. I can get over that. All right. Then that cat that 4 days previously I pulled out of a tree got run over by a car. It got hit, pulled its spine out of place, snapped its ribs, and it had to be put down. Now that cat had become my best friend in the world after I saved it from a tree because he wanted to be everywhere I was. You know, he finally realized who rules the roost. And he got run over by a car. Now I have to explain this to my kids. Well, the cat ran over by a car, you know, but okay. Well, that happened. We had to get over that. Then another of my kids got sick and had to go to the ER. So it's like, is this going to stop or what? So now I've had a cat in a tree, a dead fridge, a kid in the ER, a dead cat, another kid, okay, in the ER. Okay. Then we had, it was the night before Glad Night, and I was going to bed, and I saw a bat flying around in my house. And so we don't know what we're doing. So I had to call the exterminator guy. That cost $250 for him to come out and catch this bat. And it was, you know, it was bad. It was exciting. But it was bad, and it cost me a lot of money. And I'm like, that's wonderful. Okay, fine. So I sleep through Glad Night, or Glad Day, which is, I like going. The kids like going. We missed it. Okay. That afternoon, another bat was flying around our house. This time, I took a frying pan and I took care of it myself. Okay? So now we've had a cat stuck, a dead fridge, two kids in the ER, my cat got run over. Okay? Now I've had two bats. I'm like, I am not spending another $250 on this bat. Now, I was advised later by Steve that instead of using a frying pan, should it happen again, I should get my tennis racket out. And I did find it, so I'm just waiting for another one to come out. Okay. Now, following that, the brakes on my van died. Okay, we had an old Plymouth Voyager, and it died. I couldn't drive it. I had to take my van off the road. So now my fridge is dead, my cat is dead, my van is dead. Okay? I've got two kids who've been to the hospital, I've got bats waking up because it's getting warm outside. Well, that's okay. Nothing else can possibly go wrong, right? Baseball season started. I went out to play ball. I went, had a great time, hit a home run. Yay for me. Got home. I left my glove behind. Now, I had a glove that broke, so I bought, you know, a new one. So this is my new one, okay? And I left it behind, and I have no idea where it is, and I called the team captain. Did anybody see it? Nope, nobody saw it. It's, as far as I know, it's gone. Okay, now my baseball glove is gone. I've lost that. Then, the other day, it was hot in our house, and so I had a fan up, and it was, you know, oscillating, it was blowing around, and I decided I was going to bring it lower for the kids. So I was turning the thing, and then Carissa was doing something. So I was talking to her, and as I turned it, it released, and it fell down, and it smashed down in my hand, and I've got a mark right here. One side I got a blood blister, the other side split open, and there was just blood everywhere. Well, okay, now we're done, right? Now nothing else can go wrong. We bought a replacement van. We bought it. We went today to pick it up. Come to find, somebody forgot to get the insurance on it, so we couldn't drive it off the lot. Did you know God hates me? Did you? According to Eliphaz and Zophar and Bildad. Did you know that? Oh, he must not be a very good believer. What's he doing standing behind the pulpit? Let's get out of here. I don't want to rub off on me. Right? I'm not saying that God and Satan are having a contest over me. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that these things are happening, and I don't know why. I can't know why. I don't know all the circumstances. Maybe it was just stuff getting old. Maybe it was bad decisions on my part. Maybe it was me not paying attention. There's a saying, bad things happen, or everything happens for a reason. And sometimes the reason is you're stupid and you make bad decisions. That's just, you know. But I can't know. I can't know everything. sometimes things just happen, and you have to accept it for that. We don't have to search for some higher theological reasoning for why everything's occurring. Things just occur, and we can't know. Sometimes stuff just happens. Bad stuff, I mean. Whether it's happening to us or to others, we need to exercise caution in attempting to interpret why God has done or allowed something to happen. Many well-meaning individuals, like Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, have tried and gotten it wrong. In this case, they were blaming a righteous man for things beyond his control. Sometimes we need to admit that we simply don't have all the facts. Sometimes we need to just trust God and leave it at that. Sometimes we just need to shrug our shoulders and say, stuff happens. Stuff happens.